You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 86. This minute begins with bridge to hangar, this is the captain, and ends with Shaw still running down a hallway. And this time, I'm joined by Phil of the Matrix Minute.
Hey! It's been a while, but I have returned. I have returned to this world.
I think it's been about a year, so it's high time.
Jeez. But I'm back. Hi. I'm here to talk about this film.
This masterpiece.
Prometheus. This masterpiece.
Early this week, we recorded a Batman Forever, or 3 minutes, I should say, not 8 minutes, 3 minutes.
Yeah, Batman Forever was certainly a thing. We talked about the H.R. Giger Batmobile, so, or as he said, the Batmanmobile.
Batmanmobile.
Yeah. And, what better way to bridge that with this, right?
Yes, yeah, so that, well, this episode will be coming out this week because I just like to, you know, leave things till the 11th hour and improvise.
Sounds like me.
Yeah, I'll have to retroactively put the link to that in this episode, but yeah, it's tangentially related to our interest with Giger and the biomechanical Batman mobile.
There's not a lot of biomechanics going on in here, is there? Not a lot of biomechanical creatures in this minute.
Yeah, these your particular minutes. I have a lot to say about the Fifield monster, and it's okay, I guess.
I want to hear your opinions on it. I do.
Okay, before we get into that, I have to thank Mark Boder again for his donations through Ko-fi and helps keep the show going.
Ayo.
Helps keep me going, keeps me motivated.
We all need motivation.
So this minute mostly focuses on some mysterious thing that's shown up outside of the ship. So Yannick calls down to the hangar and he says, do you see what I see? Because that's Fifield's camera, but it's on the ground. And I mean, it goes quite quickly, but watching it and focusing on it as much as I am in this minute, it's just, oh, that is really creepy. Just the idea of, oh, okay. So, how did that get there? Did someone put it there? Is it still attached to Fifield's suit? To Fifield, you know? And if not,
oh,
who put it there?
Well, is it?
Yeah, well, we'll see very soon. I think they could have dragged this out. I know, you know, in a movie, you got to move along quite quickly. But in a TV show, I think you could have just spent a whole episode on this, just going, okay, should we go out there? No, maybe, no.
Yeah, this always happens like that, doesn't it?
So this unnamed crew member, I've got some costume notes here. He's wearing a different costume to the other crew members. So his EVA suit, it's silver and orange, it's bulky, and the sleeves and the legs are ribbed. And it has an egg-shaped helmet, so they actually had to make a totally different helmet for this. Kind of has a retro look going on. Actually, probably more accurate to a real-world spacesuit.
Hmm.
But, realistically, there's no reason to make different suits if they're all made for the same function. And, you know, presumably budget is not an obstacle for Weyland, so I really don't know why they did this.
Beats me. I'm just an observer at this point.
Yes. Well, if I might use my costume expertise, the only theory I have sort of is, so generally you have that distinction between your hero costumes and your supporting cast. So you'll, even if it's a uniform, you might do something a little different with the hero costumes. They might be more detailed or more expensive or whatever it is, depending on the kind of production.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And I guess they did that for him here, but kind of in the reverse. Like, he's a unnamed minor player, but he's the focal point of this minute. But you do, well, okay, in the background, you do have other characters with that similar costume, but they don't get close to camera. So I don't know. I would really love to know what the logic was there. The only clue, I guess, you get from the behind-the-scenes stuff is that Ridley just really loved all these different designs and he wanted to incorporate them. So, actually, I think in one of the upcoming minutes, maybe one of yours, we will see those sort of red, orangish, harder, like almost fiberglass or metallic-looking spacesuits, which we do finally see in action in Alien Covenant, in the yellow version. So, I think maybe Ridley just wanted more. He just liked them all, and he said, well, why not get DOS?
If you have the budget for it, you do it.
Yeah.
Spend that money.
It always reminds me of Sam Raimi talking about, you know, how when you've got a little budget, you know, if you need someone to spin around, you just turn the camera. And then if you're on a big budget, maybe suddenly you're building this really humongous rig to make the character spin around.
Yeah. It's not your money. You can spend it.
Yep. That must be wonderful. Just, oh, yeah, we're funding your crazy project. Go nuts.
I know. I think this is exactly what Prometheus is. Let's talk about C-sections.
Oh, boy, we've been talking about that a lot. I don't know if you've got anything about that.
Oh, you have? Okay, well, I mean, the way that the machine, I'm sure you talked about the machine and it says that it's only for the male anatomy, I guess. That's an interesting point there. And then there's also the stapling. Now, did you talk about the stapling?
Oh, not really. We just kind of skimmed over
that one. The CG staples going on there.
I think that's where CGI is the best, is where it's very subtle. It's just enhancing a scene. It's not trying to make something from scratch. I mean, these days, of course, we can do, you know, like Thanos and all those incredible characters, but a part of me, maybe just growing up in the 90s, is still impressed by, oh, wow, that's just so seamless. It's almost like a little bit of Photoshop, just a little bit of touch.
Yeah, there's a lot of, this is a pretty good example of that. However, when I was watching it, there's something about the motion. There's just a little bit about that motion that I do feel like there's, like, you can kind of tell that it's not real, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of like a floaty kind of smooth feeling when it comes down to this, to stapling, when it's hitting her flesh, because her flesh is, that's a real live action plate. And compared to the rigidity of the Squidward, the tentacle thing, I mean, I think that's where you can kind of tell. I don't know. That's how I felt when I was watching it for the first time. I remember that. Just, it's not a very big impact for her stomach or anything, so it's not going to cause a lot of resist. Like, it feels like it's kind of floating above her instead of, like, actually puncturing flesh, if you know what I mean?
Well, I guess that entire wound is all CGI, so the flesh being pulled back together, the two little
the tweezers,
robotic surgical hands, those aren't actually there. So that,
I'm just nitpicking. I don't know if this is at all interesting to anybody listening, but these are the things that concern me. You see, this is the stuff that I like talking about.
That's why I like having other people on, because things stand out to different people.
Oh no, it looks great. It looks like if you pause it, I mean, I don't think anybody could tell what's CG or not at all. Like, it's perfect. But I think, just, you know, when it comes to animation, and I always talk about this when people talk to me about computer animation for films, it's always down to human skill to be able to animate it properly. It's never really the technology that's the problem as much as it's human error.
Yeah. Or just understanding what's missing, like Corridor Crew, who I watch quite regularly. They talk about how
I love their CG talks.
So good.
It's like me and my brother, because we're big film fans, and we always have been talking and criticizing computer graphics and stuff, just, you know, for fun. So we've been through that discussion since we were like 12, you know.
Yeah.
So listening to seeing Corridor Crew, you know, those guys talk about different CG effects, and I'm always on a very judgmental level when it comes to people talking about that on YouTube, but every single time they've always talked about the right stuff. They know what they're talking about. So I respect them for that a lot.
I love anything like that, podcasts or YouTube channels that every time I come away feeling like I've really learned something and I've gotten a real insight into a world that I just never really thought about. And one example was the Gemini, or Gemini Man, as they called it.
Gemini Man. Yes.
Oh, and then the young Princess Leia in Rogue One, and talking about lip movement how everyone makes the top lip move in a way that it physically cannot do, and yet they keep doing it. Because I think a lot of what makes animation work is just observation. There's only so much that calculations can help you.
Yes.
You have to sort of bridge that gap going, well, with my eyeballs, that doesn't look right, but why? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. And that always, it's always boiling down to how much you can see, as you know, like how much you've trained to look at it, how much you've gotten used to what natural real world movements you're trying to imitate, and how you can translate that to your computer model. I mean, this is just like any skill level, for any skill set that humans would learn, you know?
Yeah. That reminds me, in one of the Silent Hill games, they used to do, what do they call it, like a FMV, where it was like they would make the cutscenes totally separate in different animation software. And this particular, I'll put it in the footnotes, I can't remember which, there's so many Silent Hills, but this animator, like the head of the CGI, well, it's all CGI, but the video parts, this was 2001 it came out, and they really had nothing like we have today in terms of the software. But the animation is spooky realistic. Like, it's in kind of an uncanny valley, but not in a bad way. And I think a lot of that comes down to how he basically just went, we're not using any sort of motion capture, we're not relying on the computer to do any sort of calculation. We're going to record the actors, and then we are going to, just like traditional animation, we're just going to try and emulate that as much as possible in controlling the shadows and the facial muscles manually, and just making it look right by eye.
Yeah.
And the result is so spooky. And for a Silent Hill game, I guess it's perfect. And it's also really important in a game like that to capture facial expressions and emotion. And they do. And this was 2001.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that goes down to the skill level of whoever's doing it, for sure.
Hmm. We see unnamed guy. He walks out as the door comes down right in front of this crumpled mass on the ground, and you can't quite make it. I mean, again, it happens really quickly, but I think they hold on it as much as they can, given, you know, it is a film and you've got like 2 hours or so to get through it. I mean, that can't be a person. It's all crumpled up. It's on the floor. No human being could be contorted like that.
Crumpled up man. You know what? Let's talk about crumpled up man.
Yes, let's.
So I don't know if I've mentioned this a year ago, because I don't remember. But this was, for me, what I was hoping. Well, not what I was hoping. Like, I didn't come in with any expectations, but I just was, when I was watching the movie and seeing how, you know, the theme is life and the theme is origins of how everything kind of develops, you know, on different, you know, not on different planets, but like in general. And then seeing, like, if someone gets into contact with that goop, right? And how it changes their biology. I was hoping Prometheus would be more, would be less about something that is here to specifically kill you, but that its side effects would be your death. Contrast between something that's beautiful and majestic and, you know, awe-inspiring, but you can't survive here, you're gonna die, you know what I mean?
Did you watch Bloody Annihilation yet?
Hell no, I didn't. I'm sorry.
I gave you homework. Well you've got a
we
week.
Have two more. Yes, we have a week. I'm gonna
two
do
more,
it
yes. Yes.
And so that's what I.
But I, absolutely love that concept, and I think you will enjoy Annihilation specifically for that.
But I want it in my Alien universe.
Exactly, yes. Who directed that? Can they do some Alien stuff? Because that would be pretty good.
So that's what I was expecting with... Fifield, is that his
Fifield,
name?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm expecting. Like when you see him, he's maybe turning into something completely different. Not necessarily a zombie man, but like,
yeah,
it's gonna sound weird, but something more planned, like, you know.
So I was gonna say the same thing. But no, but I had the exact same response. It's just, oh, he's a zombie, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. And they did initially, so there wasn't a lot to dig up in the concept art and stuff, but they were originally thinking, well, the Engineer script is totally different, and then in Paradise, yeah, this particular action sequence was added much later in production, apparently. And so there's a few concept designs, I should say, that are a bit interchangeable. So you've got the beluga morph and the baby head alien. And so the baby head was supposed to be Fifield. So the idea was that his head, it grows and extends, and then it smashes out the back of his helmet, and he just continues to mutate until it's something completely unrecognizable and disturbing. It's sort of, it's weirdly like neotenous and cute, but then it's gross. I quite like those. I'll put them in the show notes as well.
I love that stuff, and I would love it. I would have loved it if it was more something, I'm harping on about this, but it's more something that doesn't concern directly, you know, doing the horror slasher movie thing where it's like targeting specific people.
No, this is my main gripe with these minutes. So we are going to be focusing on them a lot, but yes. And then some production people said, oh, well, you know, we tried the CGI thing and it just really wasn't working. Well, I don't know. The effects in the rest of this movie are pretty damn good. I think you can do it.
Yeah.
And even if it's a guy in a costume or what, just there are ways around it. And stop motion, I don't know. But
that'd be great.
This feels so lackluster because, especially when you have the build-up of, oh, what's going to happen to Holloway? What is he going to become? And he dies before that can eventuate. But then Fifield just turns into a zombie. There's still a lot of him recognizable. It doesn't seem like he's transforming.
Yeah.
It just looks like he's...
He just looks like a... Yeah, and it's a guy in makeup as well, in the end of the day.
And, yeah, that other idea of... So he is all crumpled up, and then he slowly raises himself up, and that... It's one of those things that walks the line between goofy and creepy, kind of like everything in the movie It.
Yes, absolutely.
I remember seeing the movie It with a friend of mine, and he was laughing all the way through, and I was just like, I was very quiet and stunned, like, holy shit, oh my god. I was just edge of my seat. But he, and a lot of people in the audience, it was interesting. It was a very mixed reaction, because some people, like in the scene where Pennywise starts doing that really weird dance and there's the flames behind him and the camera's like wobbling in sync with him. And it is goofy, but it's so...
Wait, that was in the movie?
Yes,
really?
Yes.
And it's, as I show that I have not seen it.
It's an absolute meme. Yeah, I won't spoil it. But yeah, like something like that.
That's okay.
In the moment, you're just going, this is so disturbing. It's almost like... You've been abducted by John Wayne Gacy and he's in his costume and it's just, oh, I'm terrified, but this is goofy and oh my, oh, is this my last moments on Earth? Fuck. I love that, that real blend of emotions, and Ridley Scott talks about it a lot, and Sam Raimi, he's another director who loves to talk about
Sam
that.
Raimi.
Just smashing those contrasts.
Yeah, I love
and
it.
And that's why Evil Dead works, I think, is the scene where Ash has lost his mind and everything in the room is laughing with him. And he starts laughing and he goes up and down with, I think it's the lamp.
The lamp, yeah.
And it's just, It's very upsetting, but why?
I love it. That's what I strive for.
Aggressively goofy. I think that's the thing.
Mm-hmm. And how does this relate to Fifield over here?
So the way he, you know, he's all crumpled up and then he stands up and it does, it for me at least, it walks that line between, that's almost cartoonish, you know, that's almost like a Looney Tune character, clown car logic.
Yeah, yeah.
But this reminds me of, have you heard of the box alien?
No. What?
Well, my friend, this is a very odd urban legend surrounding the original Alien movie, and I don't know how to describe it other than it's just bizarre. Like, why would anyone? Okay, I have to explain it first. So
you must, because I have not heard of this. Maybe I have, but I just don't I just can't think of box alien.
It's kind of obscure, and it's actually kind of hard to Google, because if you just type in box alien, like, do you mean an alien in a box? No! I mean a bloody xenomorph, anyway. So there is a graphic novel tie-in for Alien, and one of my friends, she has it, like a full-size hardcover. She's very much a collector, so she let me borrow that, and it's pretty cool. And
oh, when was it published?
So this is the just prior to the film being released, and that's why this detail's a bit odd. And I definitely, if you can seek it out, definitely do, because it's just fun to see what these novelizations and adaptations were like in a time where that wasn't the standard, and also before Alien became Alien. It was just another movie.
Hmm.
So it was illustrated by Walter Simonson of Marvel Comics fame. He gave us most notably Beta Ray Bill of the Thor comics. And this comic is the only instance where the Xenomorph disguises itself as a box.
And
Walt insists this happened. So he said, we were flown over to an early screening, and there was a scene where Ripley's running down the hallway, it's the third act, towards the end of the film, and she sees this darkened corner, and in it is a box. And as she gets closer, it starts moving and unfurls and rises up. And this image just really struck Walt, and he said, oh, my friend next to me, I think it was maybe the writer, I can't remember, I'll put a link to the video that covers all of this, but he says, oh yeah, whoever thought it was really goofy, I thought it was really cool, and I couldn't wait to draw it. To this day, says, well, yeah, I actually had to double check this, because it was on a point where it would have affected the spacing of the comic, so yeah, there was a lot of back and forth about it. But to this day, there's no evidence of it in the film. You know, this is a movie that has been gone through with a very fine-tooth comb. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes books, documentaries, all that.
I know. Yeah, to me, this sounds a lot like the Mandela Effect.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, why did I not think of that?
I can totally understand. Like, when you were telling me the story, I was just thinking, this person describing like the box and like Ripley going to see it and it unfurling, I can see a lot of elements that were in the movie. And then it feels like once you watched it, you don't know it so well, especially if you watched it in a movie theater where, you know, the contrast ratio is great. Yeah. So there's lots of darkness as it's supposed to be. You don't see a lot. So your brain kind of starts patching things together, and you watch it once, and then honestly, like, I've had experiences like that too, where I've seen a movie and I could have sworn there was a scene in there or a shot that my brain just made up, but it actually wasn't in the movie. So
yeah,
because I know that there are
or just heightening things.
Yes, there are like moments where the alien does unfurl and it looks like he's like expanding in some shots, right? And then there's other shots where I think. The relation with Jones being put into a box, and I think that kind of thing kind of being, and then also not being able to see the alien in the ending sequence where, you know, Ripley's running around and all these lights are going everywhere. So you
it could be there as well, yeah.
Yeah, and so you kind of think that an alien, the alien is actually in the shot when it's not. And so putting all that together and then just watching it once and then just trying to remember what's going on, it really, to me, feels like that's the case this person had.
Yeah.
And it's great because we get such a wonderful image out of it.
I love it.
Is it in the graphic novel?
So he did draw it in there, and that's why it gets discussed so much, because people read it and go, what the fuck is this?
I want to see it now.
Yeah, well, I'll send you some images. But for that to have happened, so it wasn't in the script, but I mean, it's a visual thing, so that's fine. But yeah, it would definitely have to be a specific prop or a different costume, because he couldn't even sit down in that xenomorph costume, so there's no way you just do that on a whim.
Yeah.
But yes, as you said, there's a lot of times where the xenomorph sort of rises up and unfurls, and if you are watching a lower quality cut, it might have just looked like that because that's the way it was in to his eyes in the dark. But then talking to the studio and saying, is this scene still in there? Maybe this is the first example of actual genuine proof of the Mandela effect. And our Walter Simonson has been replaced by another Walter Simonson.
What?
I don't know how to feel about that. But I'm fascinated by that because, I mean, it's more than likely just a case of someone misremembering or just a miscommunication. Like, yeah, there's no evidence of who keeps letters and correspondence from decades ago, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. The paper would have just turned to dust by now, probably. But we don't have any record of that. But I could imagine just someone, just an intern responding and going, yeah, they said it was okay. And then not even really understanding what he's asking about.
Yeah. Certainly seems like it. Certainly
we
does.
Will never know the truth.
Yeah, that's what's fun about those mysteries.
But Fifield, he's all crumpled up like a box. So does Ridley Scott know about this urban legend?
Oh man, now you got me thinking about these things.
Yeah, but it's too coincidental. It's very specific. Like, who thinks of that? How often do you see that in a movie?
I don't know. I mean, you're trying to make things look scary, I guess.
There's things like, what do you call it? I think, The Ring, where, you know, someone's crawling out of a TV screen, or just the idea of, something crawling out of a space that's too small for that thing. That's definitely a recurring trope. So, maybe it's just playing with innate horror tropes.
Yeah. Seems like it to me.
Yannick says, and I'm trying to figure, maybe you know, but he all of a sudden just says, oh, hang on, or something's not right. He sort of gives that impression that something's off. But from his perspective, all he can see is now the ramps come down and spacesuit guy is there. It's what's clued him in that something's not right, other than the fact that the camera was already where it shouldn't be.
I don't know. He seems to be really confident about seeing what this thing is, which I honestly wouldn't do. I'd be sitting in the back and just being like...
Unnamed guy just kicks it, which is the classic, what is this? I don't want to touch it, but I need to.
Why? Why would you do these things? I think that's one of the biggest complaints about this movie for sure. And I honestly can't defend... I can't defend it personally. I feel like watching it again, I remember feelings of just going, I don't know why these actions are being taken by these characters.
It's classic horror bullshit where it's just the characters have to be dumb, they're expendable. I mean, I actually like,
but that can take you out
Damon
of it.
Lindelof stuff in other things. Like, have you seen Watchmen, the HBO series?
Oh, no, I haven't. I've seen the 2009 movie by Zack Snyder.
Phenomenal.
Okay, okay.
So he wrote that entire season, and it is just very smart. All the character motivations make sense, because that's, going into Watchmen. Oh, God. Are we going to have some dumb characters doing some dumb actions, or... No, it's very smart. So I think it's one of those things where it's not just the writer. It's not just the director. It's not just the studio. It really is It is a really delicate balancing act of having everyone come together at the right time and see each other's vision, I guess.
Yes, that is movie making, man. That is, it's all a collaborative process. And it seems like people who don't understand it so much and are just on the watching end and then discuss it on a podcast. No, I'm kidding. On forums and stuff like that, they usually don't understand that there's all kinds of running, like there's all kinds of moving pieces that make a movie, and it's organized chaos.
That's been a recurring theme recently, and Luke brought that up too. It's just the director's experience or the actor's experience is absolutely not the experience that the average viewer will have, and so you really do have to have a fair evaluation of a film like we're doing here. You do have to take all of that into account. You just can't go, oh, well, it's shit. Like, yeah, but what's working, what's not working, why is it not working?
And what are the circumstances of it not working or working? And, you know, things like that we'll never know, but it's always fun to talk about. Yeah. Mm.
So I'm wondering, did Fifield, like, roll up like Sonic the Hedgehog and just got to go fast? That's how he got here.
See, he just kind of rolled. Yes, like Sonic. It's perfect. Just someone do an animation. I mean, I could do that. Dun, 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 dun,
dun, dun, from, oh man, that's so my life. Where it's like, oh, I want to see that story. Oh, I guess I have to do it.
From the pyramid to the spaceship. I mean, it is a pyramid. Yeah, pyramid? I forgot how it looks like. I'm mixing up H.R. Giger's concept art with.
I have an issue with this because a pyramid is a very specific shape. It's, you know, triangular.
Yes.
Whereas this is just a temple. It's a dome shape with a skull on top.
Got it.
Yes. So I tend to call it the temple, but then it's called the pyramid in the script, so it gets confusing.
Mm. What can you do? I mean, I call it a pyramid too. Just you know, shorthand terminology.
Yeah, I guess it gets the point across. Later on, we do see that initial design. So Fifield, you know, was supposed to become this baby head alien. And there's the very similar design of the beluga morph. We see both in Alien Covenant. And that's what I really love about these movies is, and maybe it's just Ridley Scott, who just, he loves a good design and he will keep that in the back of his mind and he will come back to it. So the pyramids we were just talking about and all of that stuff, that's from the very first script for Alien.
Right. Yeah, no, I love it when people recycle these ideas. It shows their value. I mean, I feel like whoever doesn't do that would be mad. Mad, I say.
Well, as creative people ourselves, I think we've definitely encountered that where we've come up with a great design, we've got a great idea, and we love it, but then we try and put it within a certain context is just not working. We keep pushing and it's not happening. But never throw anything out. You know, if you like it on some level, it's got to find its place eventually.
Yeah. And then there's some people like myself, can't confirm or deny, who want to torture ourselves and be like, no, I did it for one thing and it didn't work. I'm not using it ever again. I have to make something new because I'm stupid.
Yeah. Yes. Whereas I've sort of, F. Scott Fitzgerald, I come back to him a lot because he's quite inspiring for the sheer fact that he is a prime example of, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Because most people are only aware of The Great Gatsby, and that's for a very good reason. Because everything else he wrote was The Great Gatsby, but he did it wrong.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And that's fascinating to me. It's just basically, he had these ideas that obviously really resonated with him that he wanted to explore, but it just didn't work those first few times, but he was still able to publish it, and I think from memory, most of them sold pretty well. But then he really cemented his legacy with only one of those books, as it is for most authors, I guess.
Right, right.
But I love that because in my writing, both original and fan fiction, there are absolutely concepts that I'm always coming back to. So it's transhumanism. It is the relationship between parent and child or creator and creation. A lot of philosophical concepts that come up in this podcast as well. And I used to just throw stuff out because I go, oh, I'm repeating myself. Oh, I'm so unoriginal. I've already done this, or this is too fanficky or too self-insertion or Mary Sue. No, do not tell yourself that that is not allowed because some dickhead on the internet said that. Because, my friend, Hideo Kojima exists and he does very well.
And I love it. Go on.
Yes, he so wonderfully and blatantly rips from the things he loves. You know, he obviously loves Escape from New York. Well, my main character is going to look like that and act like that, but he's going to be called something different so I don't get sued. But he just, if he's into it, fuck yeah. It works its way into his stories that are actually quite original. It's just that he's not shy about where he's pulling inspiration from. And good on him. I would say he's the quintessential 21st century storyteller in that respect.
Wow. I mean, look, I love Metal Gear. I mean, that's one of my favorite video games of all time, if not the favorite video game series of all time for me. And I'm a huge fan of it, in case anybody didn't know. And it's nice of you to say that because, honestly, like, I don't know if people know this, but me personally, as a human being, my passion is filmmaking, and that's what I, unfortunately, I have had a 10-year hiatus, but I'm going back on track hopefully with it soon. And I think one of the biggest problems,
it's weird that we're getting to this point in our lives where we can be like, yeah, we haven't done this thing in 10 years or 15 years. I mean
it just happens, you know, like there's circumstances on how these things happen and how they don't happen. And mine just happened to be the way it was. But, you know, as long as I understand it and I can see, okay, I still have time to go back to it. One of the things is that I'm a little bit, you know, ashamed of having to rip from different things, but I don't think that should be something you should be ashamed of. Speaking of Hideo Kojima.
Well, there is that old adage, the old adage of, you know, good artists borrow, great artists steal, so.
Right, yeah.
I mean, look at Star Wars, also not afraid to go, yeah, I like samurai stuff and Flash Gordon. I forgot. So I've been playing Death Stranding, which is the latest Kojima game. If this is
that's right. I don't have a PS4, so what can I do?
I'd lend you mine, but there's a whole planet in the way.
Literally.
Yeah. Well, apparently, if we could drill through the center of the Earth, we could get anywhere on the planet in 43 minutes.
Sure. Wait, no. Are you serious?
Don't ask me why I remember that number.
You're not serious, are you?
Literally, it's 43 minutes from one side to the other if you just go straight through the middle. Literally.
What?
Traveling not even at an absurd speed. It's just like the speed of a train, I think the calculation's based on.
No, I don't believe this.
Yeah. I gotta put that in my footnotes too so we can research this. But, yes, so in Death Stranding, there is a character called John Die Hardman, and I was just like, you fucking serious?
Die Hardman! Yeah.
I had a good laugh about that. And yeah, there's a few bits and pieces here. Obviously, like, if he's just he's a big fan of pop culture, and he's obviously a big fan of Mads Mikkelsen, he's a big fan of Guillermo del Toro, and he basically just lets those guys do what they do best. He's not trying to make them into anything other than the thing he fell in love with initially, I guess. And that's beautiful. It really is.
I agree. There's something to be learned from that.
Absolutely.
Especially when you have lots of people, especially these days when you have a lot of people who tell you when you're making something, when you're doing something creative, oh, this is too much like that. This is too much. Are you just copying this? Is it just going to be this popular property? And it's like, yeah, so what?
Yeah, because there are so many things that are very similar to other things, like Pokemon versus Digimon. I think those things are, I mean, conceptually, almost identical, but very different, because it's a different crew, it's a different storyteller, it's a different perspective.
Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to, is you are an individual, and you have had very different experiences to another person who might also like the same thing. So even if you two similar artists are going to draw inspiration from the same thing, if you're really genuine about it and you really put your heart and soul into it, then it's always going to be unique.
Yeah.
I mean, just look at Tommy Wiseau. Yeah. He put his heart and soul in that thing, and by golly, everyone loves it, and there's never been anything like it, and there will never be anything like it again. That's a key example of failing upwards. Just put more money into it. Just keep throwing more money and something will happen.
No, I mean, these are all truths. These are for real.
So we cut back to Shaw stumbling down the hallway. It's never made clear where she's trying to get to, but she does eventually come across Waylon and David. So that's where that minute ends. And all we have left is the script. And so, yes, as I alluded to earlier, nothing in the engineer's script, because, well, there wasn't a Fifield and everyone had different names. The closest thing we have is, oh, and there was no, you know, stupid vagina snake scene, so points to engineer script.
Wait, what? Oh, yeah. You mean the vagina snake from the cave?
Yeah, so they didn't do that goofy shit in the engineer script, so yes, points to the engineer script there.
Okay.
The closest thing we have to the Fifield scene is the Mutant Holloway scene on page 85 of the engineer script for those following at home.
For those following at home, yes.
Yes. Interior Magellan Engineering Deck Bilge. The lowest deck just above the gravity generators. Condensation has accumulated 6 inches of filthy water. Card and Vigoda prowl through the darkness, rifles ready. Card, who would hang out here? Vigoda, the signs lead here. A wet splatter behind them, they spin, but it's only a trickle of condensation from a drainpipe. They move on. Behind them from an 8-inch diameter pipe, a white mass oozes, almost gelatinous. Silently, as a liquid, it pours itself into the stagnant water and stands up.
Oh.
It is a humanoid demon, spindly limbs and bony back, boneless and flexible and monstrously strong, a threshing eel's tail. Its blunt dolphin head is elongated. It opens its mouth, a pair of bony jaws jut out impossibly far, hungry and demonic. The alien strikes. Card is gutted in an instant, torn up like a paper doll. He screams hideously and drops. The alien, whiplash fast, shoots away into the darkness.
Oh.
Stillwell and Downs dash in with pistols and lights. Vigoda, panicking, fires a wild burst. Stillwell ducks. Beside him, Downs arches backward into the foul water, dead. For one moment, Downs' flashlight beam illuminates the alien, a nightmare image, a translucent white goblin. Backlit, it shows the strange shape of a human face inside its fleshy skull, a mockery of Holloway, and then it's gone.
Ooh, see, I like that description with the skull face.
Why didn't we have this?
Yeah, what happened?
Would have been so cool. I love the visible skull in the Xenomorph. That's one of my favorite things. And so to do that, maybe even keeping some of something recognizable about Holloway's face under that translucent dome. Yes.
Yeah, those are fun.
Give me that.
Yeah, that's gross. Yeah, that's creepy.
Not fucking zombie generic bullshit. We've got Walking Dead for that. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I don't know why. I don't know. I guess I don't know. I don't know what to say. I don't know anybody's thoughts when making this.
So. Well, we will have some time to reflect on that, and when we do the next episode,
No, we definitely will.
Maybe watch Annihilation. It's been a year or two.
I'm sorry. I wrote it on my scheduling.
Write it on your forehead.
On my forehead, yes. I wrote it on my forehead. I wrote it in reverse, so when I look in the mirror, I can always read it.
Yeah, well, I think we ended up going more in depth than I thought we would on this minute.
So excellent.
Thank you very much for coming on.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's great.
And, well, where can we find you?
Me? Well, okay, so I'm Phil. I do different many things. So what the most appropriate place you could find me talking is our new podcast called Twofold, one word, twofold.com. No, twofoldpodcast.com. See, I always mess up with the URLs. And that's where, that's where me, because I love talking about movies, that's where me and my brother and our cousin talk about one old movie, one new movie. And we've had a good year run since June, and hopefully we're going to be, for another year, going to be going and making a bi-weekly, like two times a week, fortnight episode every single time. It's casual. It's nice. We have lots of fun arguments. It's twofoldpodcast.com.
I have yet to listen to it. I've got too many goddamn podcasts, and all my friends are podcasters. So I was like, I gotta. I love Matrix Minute. So.
Oh, and Matrix Minute. I was very happy that we made that in 2017. Yes. Now it's 2020. Isn't that something?
Oh my god! I think I started in 2017. I'm still going. I'm just going to be doing this until I die.
Ah.
And then I'm doing Tron Legacy after that. So, yeah, I'm literally going to do this until I'm dead, probably.
What about the original Tron?
Yes, okay. So, little plug. I will be on the Tron Minute, which I think starts very soon. It should be about February. And, yes, just like this podcast, I have several small existential crises talking about science fiction. So
nice.
Love it. That's already been taken care of. Thankfully, someone's done that job for me, and probably better than I can, because I wasn't alive for the first Tron, so don't have as much of a personal connection. But Tron Legacy, hell yeah, that's my jam.
Yeah, Tron Legacy. Bow, bow,
bow, bow, it's so fucking beautiful, man.
Great. Ah,
that's the world I want to live in.
It's good. It really fits you.
It does. It's definitely my aesthetic all the way through. All right, that about covers it. This is Colson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesignSide.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.
Hooray, and this is Phil signing off.